So one of the primary difficulties in MEV neutrino physics and astrophysics is something called spallation backgrounds. What spallation means is something breaks apart a nucleus, leaves behind residual pieces, and those pieces can later beta decay. And when a beta decay happens in your detector, it can look a lot like a neutrino event. This has been a known problem in neutrino physics and astrophysics for something like 50 years, and it has never been comprehensively addressed. Until now, and that's due to the thesis work of Shirley Lee, in a series of three papers with more to come, we've conducted the most thorough studies ever of these backgrounds, which, like I said, is surprising given their importance that they've never been tried to be understood. And more importantly, now that we understand them, we can control them. So let's briefly comment a little bit about MEV neutrinos and why they're so great. So, there are at least four frontiers in this field that are all very exciting, and have been very exciting, yielding all kinds of great results. And what a lot of people think, mistakenly, is that these fields are all done. There's not really anything more to do. So why is progress stalled in this field? Why do so many people think it's over? Well, some people think it's due to a lack of interesting questions, but that's mistaken. The questions remain. Some people think it's due to a lack of big detectors. That's also wrong. The problem is backgrounds. We have the detectors, but we are now limited by backgrounds. And if we can fix that, it's like getting new detectors. So let's do that. Okay, so I've just exhorted you to be interested in this area. It's done. So what we're going to talk about is how to revolutionize MEV neutrino astronomy and neutrino physics. And we'll start with what we call the haunting, then the summoning, and then the vengeance. So, and then back to why we care. Okay, so let's jump in here. So these are examples of the signals we're looking for in MEV neutrino astronomy. Nothing is happening, proton is sitting there, or an electron is sitting there, a neutrino comes in, and all of a sudden a proton moves as if pushed by a ghost, or an electron moves and we don't know why, and that's the signal. The problem is the background looks very similar. You might have a nucleus sitting there minding its own business, another nucleus appears, you can't see it, a neutrino goes out, you can't see it, you just see an electron move. Again, it looks like it was pushed by a ghost. Yeah?
So when you say MEV,
yes.
What's the energy range?
Okay, good question. So let's say I'm interested in 1 to 20 MeV, and I'll explain why that range shortly. And the reason let's comment on it. Basically, the endpoints of all the highest Q value beta emitters go up to 15, 16, 17, and then there's some energy resolution. So that problem ends at 20. Okay, so we do have detectors built or under construction or planned. And most people think Super K is basically over. That's quite wrong. It's about to be rejuvenated in an exciting way. And it's important because it's so huge. You probably know that Juno is under construction and Dune is now basically launched towards construction. I think there's some kind of grand opening event today on the LBNF Dune plan. So we will have very large detectors. And so the signals I'm interested in, the things we need are really, really big detectors, as opposed to smaller, more precise detectors. The things I'm most interested in, big is what matters. An ice cube, while huge, has impossibly large backgrounds, and I don't know how to fix that. So these are the biggest detectors we have. And yet, they are not good enough. Okay, so that's the first thing we have to do to make progress in this field. We need bigger detectors. Good. So the second thing we need to do is better specificity on neutrino flavors. This story you've heard before is a way to tag new EBAR events. It's signal selection. It's not exactly background reduction, it's signal selection. A signal event of a new EBAR on a free proton would produce a positron, that's well known, and with gadolinium, Super K could detect the subsequent neutron. This basic idea was used, of course, by Reines and Cowan in the 50s to first detect antineutrinos from a nuclear reactor, but they were using a scintillator and they were using cadmium. Cadmium versus gadolinium is not a big deal. Gadolinium is a little better. The important thing is all those many decades that people used gadolinium in scintillator detectors, nobody thought it could be done in a water detector. So our innovation was saying, you can put gadolinium in a water detector and you can detect neutron captures in a water detector. It works. And that hadn't been done before. And when we started shopping this idea around, all experimentalists came to us and said, it's impossible. And it's impossible for this reason. So by the way, my collaborator, Mark Vagans, is a real experimentalist on Super K. I'm just a meddling theorist. And people said to us, I'm sorry, you know, gadolinium is not soluble in water. Okay, in my office, I have a jar, 50% gadolinium by weight in water. It's perfectly clear. Gadolinium's too expensive. It's about as cheap as coffee, and very important also for experiments. There's not enough in the world. There's plenty, et cetera. All of those problems, we got past them one by one, and there were many, and many of them were very challenging, and some took many months of careful work to figure out how to beat. So this was a long time ago, 2004, we proposed this thing. And you might wonder what happened. And the answer is, for about 10 years, we worked on all of these things. Mark, mostly invisibly to you, did very, very extensive experimental laboratory work on all the gadolinium stuff. So the hard thing about Super K, it's dirty, it's full of radon, other things. You need to purify the water constantly. And if you do that in the conventional systems, it will remove the gadolinium. So that's not so good. So first of all, you have to find samples of gadolinium that are chemically pure, radio pure, And you also have to find a way to purify the water and the gadolinium separately. That's a very complicated plumbing system that Mark designed. And he did many, many other things like that, building test tanks and all of that stuff, proving that the gadolinium would not destroy Super K. That happened behind the scenes. Meanwhile, I was working on the theory side of trying to show why all the signals would be so important, what we could measure, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so we finally got an answer, and the answer is yes. And so in 2015, Super K said, we are doing this. I'm pleased that this is, 10 years may sound long, but it's actually incredibly fast. So it's good, it's under construction right now. You're not building a new Super K, but they have to build all the water purification stuff, so they, caverns, stuff is being built right now, and we hope the gadolinium will be deployed in Super K within a few years.
You have the test facility for this separate, right?
Yeah, there were two test facilities. The first one was in the 1 kiloton water detector on the surface, and that is a long and interesting story I could tell you at a coffee break, but the short version is, Mark put the gadolinium in that water, and then things were pretty great for a few days, and then all of a sudden, the water transparency went to basically zero. They said, oh shit. So they started, you know, circulating the water faster and doing all kinds of things, and eventually they're looking at the filters and there's giant piles of orange crud. It's bad. It looks like rust. I guess I'm telling the story. Okay, so that was bad. And they freaked out, and then eventually they had to drain the detector, and Super K management and the Mitsui Shipbuilding Company were there, and Mark was there. He was called to account, and he was like, Mark, you're destroying this detector. This was a very bad moment in the history of Gadzooks, because it looked like gadolinium in water had epically failed. And Mark was very thoroughly yelled at for screwing up this detector. Then they drained the detector, and they discovered that this detector is not made of stainless steel. Okay, they knew there was not. Super K is made of stainless steel. It doesn't rust. This detector was made of just pig iron. It had been carefully painted with rust-resistant paint by the Mitsui Shipbuilding Company, who swore up and down that they had painted every square centimeter of the interior of this. So then, Suzuki, the boss of Super K, was saying to Mark, Mark, gadolinium trichloride, whatever you were using at the time, eats through the paint and rusts out the walls, and that's bad for Super K, you can't do it. They drained the detector, and it turns out that the Mitsui guys one day had not bothered to come back from lunch, and most of the walls were painted with this rust-resistant, like battleship paint. But there was a many, many square meter section that they had never bothered to paint. And it was covered with rust. And it turns out if you add gadolinium trichloride, it liberates pre-existing rust like crazy because of the chloride. But it doesn't cause rust. So anyway, that was a very scary, scary moment. We have about 10 other stories like that where it looked like all was lost. Some on the theory side, some on the experimental side, and nevertheless, things worked.
Did you bring like an anti-neutrino source to see how the efficiency is?
No. To bring what?
An anti-neutrino source?
No, no, we didn't bring an anti-neutrino source. But so then the second detector is underground, and that's called EGADS. And that one has been extremely successful, and you can look at pictures of that on the internet. Okay, so those are two steps. Now we need the third step. The third is, let's just remove all the backgrounds. Let's stop fooling around and just kill all the backgrounds. This is incredibly more ambitious than just the gadolinium idea. Gadolinium, as I said, is signal selection. This is just make the backgrounds go away. So for example, in solar neutrinos in Super K, you've seen this picture. These are solar neutrinos scattered away from the sun by electron scattering, and all of this crap is backgrounds, all of this stuff here. This is already, backgrounds have already been reduced by a factor of about 10. And yet, backgrounds are still remain serious. So our goal is to make these backgrounds go away 10 times more, and that's Shirley's work. So those backgrounds are caused by two things. Let me just tell you right now, below 6 MeV, it's dominantly radioactivities, primarily from the radon chains. We cannot do anything about that today, period. We focus on above 6 MeV, which is well tied to, for example, solar neutrino surges. And what we're going to try to do is make the backgrounds above 6 MeV go away by a factor of 10. And then they will be irrelevant. Okay, so what causes spallation? It turns out what most people thought was completely wrong. What most people thought is, muon goes through the detector, hits a nucleus, breaks it apart, and later it beta decays. So if it beta decayed immediately, it's the beta decayed light would be lost with the muon light, and then you would just cut it, no problem. The problem is the beta decay happens later. So like nitrogen 16 has a lifetime of like 7 seconds. So the muon goes through, you're done, okay, don't look while the muon's there, and then later, boop, that's bad. So what people would do is they would imagine a virtual cylinder, because Super K has good position resolution. They would imagine a virtual cylinder around where the muon was, and they'll say, look, cut it to a few meters, and let's cut for a few seconds, several seconds. Don't look in that volume, because there might be a spallation beta decay. That part is all good and correct. The part that was wrong is people thought that muons broke nuclei and made the spallation decays, and that turns out not to be true. Okay, so the problem in Super K is the muons are coming at 2 hertz. And if you want to cut these volumes for several seconds, pretty soon you get to the point that the volumes are overlapping. Already Super K is losing 20% of their lifetime to these volumes. So that's too much. They would like to make these cylinders bigger and have them last longer. They would like to cut harder, but they're already losing 20% of the signal, and they can't cut harder without ruining everything. So our goal is to be able to cut harder and not lose signal. Okay, so the spallation backgrounds are important for a wide variety of other searches. Let's not go into details. Okay, so the first part is figuring out what makes the isotopes. And it's actually not the muons themselves, but it's their secondary particles. That part was known, including from work I did with Galbiati in 2005, but there's an important detail that was not appreciated. Okay, so here come the muons. Typical energy in Super K is several hundred GeV. Typical energy loss is, for a minimum ionizing or near minimum ionizing particle, is several GeV. It turns out, I'll just give you a preview, these muons are not the problem. These are basically minimum ionizing muons. They're very common. They don't really make isotopes. These are the ones that make isotopes. These are the ones that make isotopes. And you'll notice that these are rare, but they're extraordinarily dangerous. They don't look very important here, but it turns out they are. So they make a variety of secondary particles as they travel. The plot on the left takes a little bit of getting used to. It's what's called a path length spectrum, or basically it's an inverse dVx spectrum. So what this, there's many, many particles in a shower, and they're coming and going all the time. So it's not a well-posed question to ask how many electrons and positrons are in a shower. It's a well-posed question to ask at a particular instant, but it's not well-posed to ask how many were ever there over the course of the shower. Because also, what if it only went this far versus one that went this far? What you want to know is, at 200 MeV, how many electrons went how far? At 199 MeV, how many electrons went how far? And that's what this figure shows you. And so it says that when muons go through matter, there are lots of secondary gammas and electrons and some pions and neutrons and all of that junk. And the distance that those secondaries can go from the muon track is some couple of meters. Turns out that all of the isotopes, basically, except a couple of percent, are made by these secondary particles. And among them, the ones that are the most important are the rare ones, the neutrons and the pions. We'll come back. So one of the things we were able to do is make predictions for all distillation yields in Super K. I don't have a plot to show it, but later these numbers were well confirmed by measurements in Super K. On the right, we show a figure which particles are making isotopes and what energies they have. And so neutrons, basically hundreds of MeV neutrons and pions are the best for making spallation isotopes in water. Carbon is a little special in their gammas are important in carbon to make carbon 11. So the other thing we looked into is the compounds. So we, through Shirley's work, we were able to get the individual spallation yields. And so for everyone, we know the time profile of the decays, and we know the energy spectrum of the decays, and we can add up all of those pieces with the proper weights, and we can compare the totals to things that Super K had measured. So on the left is the composite time spectrum, time profile, and on the right is the composite energy spectrum. And those are in good accord with Super K data, but now we know the components. Super K only knew the totals. Notice the figure on the left is a little weird looking because we've multiplied by T. There's a good reason for that. And you see there's a handful of isotopes that matter the most. Okay, so the next part is to understand exactly how these are made in terms of the secondaries. And the short version is almost all of the isotopes are made in showers. The muon is making secondaries all the time, but it's only when the muon makes a big batch of secondaries that you get isotopes. And in particular, when it's a hadronic shower, it's the most likely. Okay, so this is a shower, an electromagnetic shower on the left. You know what it looks like. Here's a picture from a simulation, what it looks like in a detector. A hadronic shower is similar, it's just lots and lots of pions. So when a muon has, so here's an example of some injected showers. So for example, an electromagnetic shower of 10 GeV, if we put in a 10 GeV electron or gamma, then what does it do? It showers, making many, many, many more electrons, positrons, and gammas. And this plot is their path length spectrum. And most of the particles are near the critical energy, as you expect for a shower. Most of the path length is accumulated near the critical energy. And one of the other things we've done is we've divided by the total injected energy here. So you see that showers are kind of near universal. One shower at 100 GeV is basically the same as the sum of 10 GeV showers, which is the same as 101 GeV showers in terms of the path length spectrum. There's, you know, a higher energy shower makes more particles at high energy. That's not important. All the path length is accumulated near the critical energy of the electromagnetic or the hadronic shower. In a hadronic shower, the pions are much, much more important, and that turns out to be quite important. So the key idea here is showers have a near universal behavior, and almost all of their path length is accumulated at relatively low energies. And that's where spallation isotopes are made effectively. So you might say, who makes those showers? And on the left, we show the secondaries that are made by a muon as it passes through the detector. lots of delta rays, scattered electrons. Of course, there's pair production, there's Bremsstrahlung, there's heteroproduction, things like that. This is what's actually made by a muon as it passes through Super K. And then we take those and we simulate showers accordingly. So, you know, high energy showers are rare, low energy showers are more common. And showers have a length of typically several meters. Now, one of the things that we found in this work, so one thing you may not know about electromagnetic shower and a hadronic shower. Electromagnetic shower stays mostly electromagnetic, electrons, positrons, and gammas. That's basically it. A hadronic shower immediately becomes electromagnetic because in a hadronic shower you make pi plus, pi minus, those go on to make more hadrons, and pi zero, which immediately decays to gammas and starts an electromagnetic cascade. Then you go to the next generation, you make three more pions again. Pi plus, pi minus, oh, pi zero. Then every step you bleed off one third of the energy into an electromagnetic cascade. So all of the light comes from the electromagnetic cascades, from electrons and positrons that make Cherenkov light. And what this figure on the left takes some time to understand, but what the top figure says is, when you make showers of a whatever energy, the right way to say this is electromagnetic showers are very, very good at making light, but they're actually that's why they're important here, but they're pretty terrible at making isotopes, that's why they're less important here. Hadronic showers, these are normalized by rate, so hadronic showers are less common perfectly good at making light, they're just less common. So they're less common, but they make most of the isotopes. So the goal is to find the hadronic showers. But first we need to find the showers at all. So this also shows that more shower energy leads to more isotopes, and then also that where the shower is where the isotopes are made. Let's skip that step. So here's the part where we try to control this. First thing we want to do is figure out where the shower is. And what we do is when a muon goes through super K, like this, when it does make a shower, it makes many electrons and positrons and everything like that, and they all make Cherenkov light. And they almost all go forward. So let's imagine that the muon is going straight this way. If all the electrons and positrons were exactly forward and collinear and online with the muon, it would just make one super bright ring on the wall. The electrons and positrons are aligned with the muon, but they're slightly tilted. And those slight tilts blur the Cherenkov rings on the wall. And so you can't reconstruct the shower by assuming the Cherenkov angle, but what you can do is PMT by PMT, you can reconstruct. So this PMT got hit, and you can ask, I know where the muon is, I know which PMT got hit, where did that photon come from, and what angle was it emitted at relative to the muon? And it's not the Cherenkov angle, because again, the electrons and positrons are deflected. If you put all of that together, you can, so on the, one more step. On the left shows a real shower, how much Cherenkov light should be made along the muon. So the muon's going along, it's minimum ionizing, minimum ionizing, minimum ionizing, boom, it makes a shower, there's a lot more Cherenkov light. Then it goes back to minimum ionizing, boring. This is what the shower actually looks like in super K. And that, this was the starting point of this investigation, was looking at plots like this, whoops, plots like that, and saying, that doesn't look like a shower at all. And that our initial hypothesis was, everything is being done here by showers, but then we saw this figure and we said, that's not a shower. And so we had to figure out why it must be showers, but that's not a shower. And it turns out it's poor reconstruction, and we were able to fix it. This figure on the left shows at a given PMT, you know the PMT position on the wall, and you ask what time it got hit. And then by putting that all together, you can reconstruct where the light came from. When things go straight along the muon track, they make light right along this brightest ridge. When particles are deflected, they make light that fills this upper space. And by reconstructing this light in the upper space, you can figure out where the shower was. And this, if you didn't know where the shower was at all, you would just cut everywhere along the muon length. If this figure shows how to figure out where the shower is, and with various improvements, so the gray is where the shower actually is, and with a couple of improvements, the blue shows how well we can fit it. So there's a little baby shower here, another little one here, and a pretty big one here, and we fit it pretty well. We're not fitting something that's 30 meters wide, which is what Super K was doing. 30 meters wide is almost the whole detector. So what you can do is then instead of cutting everywhere along the muon track, you can say, harmless muon, harmless muon, harmless muon, oh, let's cut like crazy, harmless again, because now you know where to look. And these are examples of showers and where the isotopes are made. So the ice, here's an isotope that was made in this small shower. Could have also been made in this shower, but it wasn't made in between when the muon was more boring. Okay, so the goal here is to apply this shower reconstruction technique to isolate a smaller region of the muon track and cut it much, much harder. So we get better efficiency for cutting and less dead time, so less loss of signal. The next step that we're working on is showing which showers are hadronic as opposed to electromagnetic. So if we can identify the hadronic showers, they're more rare, and then we can really, really cut those without any dead time at all, almost. So we are pretty confident that we can reduce this background by an order of magnitude, and that will change this game. We're also working on the physics consequences of this for this and other detectors. So I focused here today on Super K, but all of these signals at low energies are hostage to spallation backgrounds. And all of the detectors, pretty much, with one exception, which is SNO and SNO Plus, does not need to worry about spallation backgrounds because it's so incredibly deep. Every other detector has to. And so these techniques are quite general. We'll be applying them to a variety of detectors and going after all of these physics goals. So these are examples, again, of the places that it matters. Shirley, this is a slide from Shirley, as she shows here, in all of these different searches, spallation remains important after cuts. So if we can make it less, that'll help. Okay, so what's the takeaway messages? Four things, I think. First is a lot of important physics depends on detecting MEV neutrinos. You know that, I didn't really dwell on it. There are several ways to make progress. One thing that is hard to do is make much bigger detectors. We'd love to have hyper-K, we'd love to have a megaton detector, whatever. So far that has not materialized, so we have to work with the detectors we have. One thing, if you can't make the detector bigger, you can make the background smaller. Spallation is very important, and it seems to now be understood theoretically for the very first time. And on the basis of that, we can devise a bunch of very effective cuts. Super-K, okay, so it comes back to the meddling theorist part. People always say to me, but you're just a meddling theorist. Why would the experimentalist pay any attention to what you do? Well, one thing is I try to be helpful to them and be nice about it, and typically is pretty effective. And Super-K is adopting these techniques. They've adopted the techniques in the papers we've written so far, and they're already adopting the techniques in a paper that we haven't written yet, but we have shared with them the technique, and they're coming back and they're saying, this works incredibly well, we're excited. So this is gonna be really good, and the cool thing is, they should be able to go back and apply this to 20 years of solar neutrino data, retroactively redo the cuts. So we're very, very excited about that. So it's like, okay, so several years ago, a three-letter agency in Washington, D.C., the National Reconnaissance Office, came to some astronomers and said, oh yeah, Hubble, you got Hubble, right? Yeah, we've been cleaning out the garage, and we found a couple of spare mirrors. They're Hubble class, they're not very good, nobody's using them, there's only two, and they're only Hubble class, but they're in a garage, we kind of got to clean it out because, you know, grandma's moving in or something. Do you want them? And the astronomer said, yeah. And so one of those is W-first, gonna be the W-first mirror. Imagine that there was a Super-K, there was a stealth Super-K that had been operating for 20 years, and you never heard of it, and it was just like Super-K, just it had no backgrounds. And you found out tomorrow they're going to release a paper on their physics results. Would you read that paper? Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do, is help them write that paper. So the last thing is, this body of work, these three papers and those to come, including some spin-offs that are important for IceCube, this work was all led by my now ex-graduate student, Dr. Shirley Lee, who just graduated like a week ago, or finished a week ago, whatever. So the final message is, keep an eye on her career. Thanks. Yes?
I have two questions, because I'm not an expert in this. So you mentioned there is also other backgrounds.
Yes.
In that block where you have this flat, how much green is the
In this plot, 5 or 6 MeV, it doesn't make a huge difference. Basically, in this plot, it's all spallation. Below here, to make an energy, so this would be, there we go, this way. Here's an energy spectrum versus low energy to high energy. Spallations are sort of here, and then there's a wall due to radon daughters and energy resolution. Radon daughter is like a 3 MeV, but at super-K energy resolution, not so good. So below about this energy, we don't know what to do yet.
But in this energy, you really would get like that.
Yeah.
So the other question is, you have also new interaction with the carbon. They will produce neutron that they will produce foundation.
Yeah.
So I have no idea how much this is with respect.
So that's a problem as well. We took that into account. What he's mentioning is, of course, you know, there's muons in the rock that you don't see. This technique only works on the muons you can see. Basically, we have a 5 meters of water to get from the rock to the fiducial volume. There's an instrumented outer detector, there's a well-instrumented inner detector, it's safe.
That's his
We found that effect, Rafael.
Negative. Also two questions. First one, I didn't catch that. Where in South Korea is that other Super-K detector from the NRI? The second question is, I feel like I've heard that talk, except in a different context, when IceCube talks about reconstructing their muon energies much better by no longer assuming a constant DEX, but taking into account that you have the delta electrons. is that, can you sort my, can you calibrate me, is that the same?
So the the ice cube technique for measuring the DDX along the muon track is related. It's more of a, I think it's more of a template type fit. This is actually individual reconstruction, one photon at a time. So at very high energy, showers can be done by templates. These are custom tailored because they're relatively low energy showers. And the fluctuations in individual showers matter for us. So I don't care what a generic 1 GV shower looks like. I care about this particular 1 GV shower. At 100 GV, all showers look the same. Yeah?
Could Sushay get Kendall and then part of the neutrinos, solar neutrino spectrum, high energy neutrinos, right? I mean, about 4 and 8. Is it possible using?
So one of the things that I didn't mention, so the boron 8 spectrum goes down, 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 and then at 10 to the minus 3 level, there's this little tiny thing called the HEP spectrum that emerges has a Q value of a few MeV higher, but its flux is 10 to the minus 3 of boron 8. Yes, that's one of the things we hope to isolate with this body of work. That HEP spectrum has never been measured.
And it's sort of theoretically very
messy. Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Because it's nice.
We hope to get it fast.
It's so low, right, that the signal rate expected, even some supergate size, is
poor. Yeah, and then another problem in superk is the energy resolution, because the boron 8 signal can bleed out, and then that can bury the HEPs. Still, we're trying.
So what does it tell? I can't remember. I knew this once. If you measure HEP, what does it tell you?
Well, one cool thing about measuring HEP is, this is not that, I just wanted to leave this up for fun. One cool thing about measuring HEP is that it's produced at a different point in the sun. And so you might say, hey, if I could measure a 15 MeV boron 8 neutrino and a 15 MeV HEP neutrino, they have a different survival probability, even though their energy is identical. And in principle, you could use that as a way of measuring delta M squared. That's something I'm interested in and been trying to work on, but it looks quite challenging. But the concept is good, and there's a real difference in the survival probability. I just don't know how to make it work yet. Okay, so one thing I forgot to say at the beginning is I wanted to thank the audience, participants of this conference, because this has been really, really quite great, I think. I've really enjoyed all the amazing physics we've heard about, and also the kind of fun, constructive, friendly atmosphere that's been here. And I thank everybody for their role in that. But I think I want to especially thank Joe, who led our efforts to organize this conference. There were two meddling theorists and one meddling experimentalist, but really there was one leader, and that was Joe. And so I'd like to thank Joe for doing such a great job.